Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and as always, I want to welcome my wonderful co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Dave. And unfortunately, we don't have Robert with us today, but he is taking a much-needed vacation and will be back soon, and he will put in our music and our clip and everything later on. So we will miss him, but we'll still have a good show today, even without him, even though we miss him. So hope you guys are doing well. Hope everyone's having a good day. And today's episode is titled, A Quality of Mercy.
And now, Mr. Serling.
It's August 1945. The last grimy pages of a dirty, torn book of war. The place is the Philippine Islands. The men are what's left of a platoon of American infantry, whose dulled and tired eyes set deep in dulled and tired faces can now look toward a miracle. That moment when the nightmare appears to be coming to an end. But they've got one more battle to fight. And in a moment, we'll observe that battle. August 1945, Philippine Islands. But in reality, it's high noon in the Twilight Zone.
So, before I begin, I do want to welcome Rick, and I want to welcome Ed, who's not here yet, but he should be on soon. What I want to do now is give you the summary for Quality of Mercy, and that's episode centers around a young gung-ho American soldier, an officer in World War II, by the name of Second Lieutenant Cattell. He orders a platoon of war-weary soldiers to make a near-suicidal attack on a group of sick and wounded Japanese soldiers holed up in a cave not too far away from them. Now, Sergeant Cotterano, who knows that these men have had enough of war, tries to talk him out of it and tells him the attack will accomplish nothing except for pointless deaths on both sides. But Cattell pulls rank, of course, and he stands firm on his orders, intent on proving himself. So suddenly, out of nowhere, Cattell drops his binoculars, and he suddenly finds himself in Corregidor 3 years earlier in the war. It's a new perspective. He is now Lieutenant Yamori. And as you Lieutenant Yamori, he's now in the Japanese army, and he's ordered to attack a group of American soldiers in the same cave. And he tries in vain to convince his captain not to attack. But the Japanese captain believes Yamori's either sick with malaria or a fever, or worse than that, that he's actually lost his nerve, that he now has become a coward. So he tells him to straighten up or he's going to stay there with the wounded. And suddenly, out of nowhere again, Cattell finds himself back in 1945 as an American soldier with his men telling him that they've gotten word that the A-bomb has been dropped and they've been ordered not to attack the cave and to fall back. Suddenly, Cattell seems relieved in light of his unnerving experience, of course, and when Cotterano tells him there'll be other wars and other enemies to kill, Cattell says, God help us, I hope not. Well, now, in my opinion, this was one of the more lackluster Twilight Zone episodes. I didn't hate it, but I didn't find it all that exciting either. This episode was very much, a morality play. Morality play, I guess. It was one of those, there's a lesson to be learned here types of episodes. And the lessons to be learned were originally in the Bible and the Declaration of Independence. In the Bible, I believe it was the book of Matthew that says, judge not, lest ye be judged. and the Declaration of Independence tells us that all men are created equal. Well, Lieutenant Cattell unwittingly learned both of these lessons the hard way as his alter ego, Lieutenant Yamori. And as Yamori, he came to realize that both sides played the roles of the hunters and the hunted. And each side had one common goal, and that common goal was to eliminate the enemy at all costs. As an American, he would have liked to kill all the Japanese. Just as his Japanese captain strongly stated that he needed to destroy all the Americans. So Yamori's change of heart came very quickly. And once again, we have to suspend our disbelief because there is no real explanation for Cattell's transportation other than him dropping his binoculars. And then you also have the scene where he first realizes he's among the Japanese soldiers, and he runs off like a scared rabbit. And then when he joins the Japanese soldiers again, one of them praises him because he thinks he took off running to attack the Americans head-on by himself. And I found that rather strange because he didn't run away like a man on a mission. He took off like a man who was scared out of his wits. And, of course, again, it's another one of those suspension of disbelief moments. Of course, I did think the acting was very good. I'm not going to say anything bad about the acting. I always, always, always like seeing Albert Salmi. He was a terrific actor. He appeared in 3 Zone episodes. Most of us probably know that. He was in The Execution, which we've already reviewed. Quality of Mercy, that's this one. And also in, what's the other? Oh, of late, I think, of Clifferville. And that was one of the hour-long episodes from season 4. We'll be reviewing that one much later on. But it was funny because last time I watched this, which was last night, I was thinking that if Albert Salmi were playing this role as his character Joe Caswell in Execution, he probably would have knocked the crap out of Cattell because as Sergeant Casarano, he and his men, they were war-weary, and they had no patience for Cattell's bloodthirsty rantings. And Salmi, he always plays this role. All of his roles, really, with a wonderful intensity. I mean, he's great. He's convincing in all of them. And Dean Stockwell was good. Of course, Leonard Nimoy, he had a small part here, but he had the most successful career out of the whole cast due to a little project called Star Trek. So, and also, some or most of you might know that Rod Serling, he served in World War II, so it's no wonder that he wrote this episode. And also, he wrote The Purple Testament from season 1. So as the expression goes, he'd been there, he'd done that. So I'm just going to say this wasn't a horrible episode, but definitely not one of the best ones. And I would give it a 2 rating for average. And I'm going to turn this over to Bobby now because he wanted to go next, and then Dave.
All right, Elin. Thanks very much. Far be it from me to suggest that I can replace Robert because I don't have any audio clips or anything, but I'll try to keep people awake for at least 5 minutes anyway. It's the least I can do. But this episode, actually, strangely enough, though, I don't have a whole lot good to say about it. I don't mind it when it first begins. I think it's a better story when it first begins than later on. The story of world-weary soldiers at the end of a war who are questioning whether or not they have to fight this last battle just to prove how tough they are or that they can wipe out all the Japanese to the very last man is a more interesting story than where Serling took it, because he all of a sudden, it's as though he woke up in the middle of it and remembered that he was doing a science fiction series. So he had to have this very bizarre thing happen where the lieutenant turns into Japanese. That looks kind of strange. There's some mixture there that just doesn't work for me. I think it would have been a better story if it just stuck to the beginning of it, with him being as obviously racist as he is, and whether the soldiers are going to go along with this now that the war is almost at an end. So instead we come to this odd business of him suddenly being on the other side. The other thing I have to question about is war itself. I don't have, and thankfully, any experience being in a war. I wasn't in Vietnam or anything like that, but I've seen enough war movies, read enough stories, real-life stories about real-life war to realize that there's no quality of mercy in words. It doesn't exist. It really doesn't matter because all you know is that you're in a war and people are shooting at you. And if you don't shoot them back or try to kill them first, they're going to kill you. It's as simple as that.
They're not people.
Well, I mean, in that setting, there's simply no time to consider whether there's any mercy or not. I'm not sure that this group of soldiers really had the right to take it upon themselves to decide that enough is enough because the reason they were sent there is to just fight until the war is definitely over. And though it is over by the time the episode ends, it's not over at the beginning. I'm not really taking the side of the lieutenant. I think he was too gung-ho, obviously. He seemed to relish in killing people. But the reality of it is that I'm not sure if I was in the same situation, I would have time to consider any kind of mercy. Nor do I believe, excuse me, nor do I believe that even if somebody could magically be on the other side, that they would see things differently. I don't buy into that. The idea here is that if only you could be on the other side and see how difficult it is for them too,
right,
you might not be so gung-ho in a war. But it's not that simple. This is a war. It's not, you know, there's nothing personal about it. It's just that people are trying to kill you. And if you don't take care of business on your own end, then you'll end up being the dead one. It's that simple. Now, recently we've seen famous movies like Saving Private Ryan and make war in its guttiest portrayal, showing how difficult and how hideous and horrible it is. And there's no time for this kind of nonsense. So that's the problem I have with it. I also agree with Lynn that it was kind of strange that he was so gung-ho about killing people that when he suddenly, I guess he drops his binoculars or something, and he comes to and he realizes he's on the other side.
He dropped his binoculars. That's how he got transported. He dropped his binoculars.
He realizes he's on the other side, and he's such a bastard here and so willing to kill people. It made me wonder why he didn't just pull out a gun and start shooting immediately when he saw the Japanese in front of him. He didn't really have time. I can understand why. I was scared. I would have been scared out of my wits too. But all of a sudden he's running off. I would have thought he would have just pulled out a gun and immediately started shooting everybody. So it did seem kind of odd that he took off like a scared rabbit, because that certainly is different than he was at the beginning. But I suspect that that was Sterling's whole point, that it was easy to be that gung-ho when you're on one side, not so easy when you're on the other side. But the problem I have with it is I just think that there's nothing to be gained here at all. That I don't think anybody would really change their mind in a war setting if they could see, because you can easily see it from the other side. How much does it take? These guys have been in war for a long time. They're obviously beaten to death. They've had enough. They can't stand it anymore. So they know how it is on the other side. It's the same way it is for them. And I don't think you can really learn any kind of lesson. Now, whenever we do these stories on the radio like this, I always like to go to the Internet Movie Database to see what's going on over there about this. And this episode gets a 7.5 from posters there, which is a pretty good rating out of 10. And usually
I said that's surprising.
Yeah, well, most people like it. I haven't had a chance to look at all the reviews, but usually that's all that's there. People make reviews, but there is a so-called professional review over there written by a person who has taken it upon himself to review either all of or most of the Twilight Zone episodes. And he did this one over there, and I'm not going to read his entire review, but I do want to mention just a couple of things that he says, because I pretty much agree with what he has to say. It's not a complimentary review. He did not like the episode. He found it rather racist, to tell you the truth. And I have to agree with some of these feelings. And another thing I want to mention before I get into that is that this episode it says at the beginning of it, it was written by Rod Serling from an idea by another man. I don't know whether the other person is a writer or what. It almost looks like he was having dinner with him one day, and he said to him, you know what would make a good story? What if a man was in a war and he suddenly found himself on the other side? Because that's what it looks like. Looks like this idea just came out of nowhere, and Serling just thought to himself, that's an interesting theory. Well, what happened if you found yourself on the other side all of a sudden? Would you be scared? Would you still have the same attitude? Anyway,
the guy's name is Sam Rolfe, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah, right. I don't know who he is. I tried to find out whether he's a writer or whatever, but there's no information there. It just says from an idea by, which is unusual, because usually when Serling writes teleplays, they're from stories. They're from other stories by writers.
He's a screenwriter. He wrote for The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, really? You do know him?
Oh, no kidding.
Is that right? So he was a writer.
Put up a link.
Yep, he's a writer. I believe he was also script editor for Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Really?
Oh,
all right. Well,
awesome.
Then he should have gone and written this whole story out. Giving the idea.
Should let him do it.
Well, yeah, if he has the experience, he should have taken it the rest of the way. Anyway, a couple of things from that person's review. He says here at the beginning, pedantically taking its name from a line in The Merchant of Venice, the quality of mercy is an ineffective anti-war episode that, for all its brotherhood of man ideals, is detrimentally gimmicky, not to mention dated, in its unconscious, and he puts a question mark after that, racism. I have to agree with that. It does almost look that way. Then later on, just give me a second here to get down to it. I mean, I don't know that there's anything really deliberate on the part of Serling to do it that way, but it almost strangely enough, comes across that way. Then he writes later on, Stockwell's lieutenant in his bloodthirst is a little cartoonish, though Stockwell restrains himself and avoids chewing the scenery. Serling's writing, however, is not so understated. Stockwell, through unspecified magic, is transported 3 years into the past, as if it wasn't enough to transport a man through time. I think he's turning Japanese. I really do. It is kind of strange. He just seems to turn Japanese out of nowhere. And it's really, I know that it's only a 23-minute episode. There's really not a whole lot of time to get into that. But still, it seems a little odd. I have to agree with some of his comments on this. And that's what really, I think, hurts the episode. It just looks ridiculous from beginning to end. And it's an uneasy mixture of what could be a real-life incident as far as these men not wanting to listen to the lieutenant and being, you know, all of a sudden finding himself on the other side. So I like the acting. I think the acting is pretty good, actually. And it's a pretty compelling story. This story, by the way, of world-weary soldiers having enough is nothing new. It's been done many, many times. And at the time that this aired on TV, there was also a TV series on in the early 60s and mid-60s, and it's still seen in reruns on MeTV called Combat, and that followed soldiers from week to week to week as they marched across Europe, getting into all kinds of problems. And it was my mother's favorite TV show, strangely enough, and I used to watch it with her, and they did stories like this. They did plenty of stories like this, in which you had to wonder, was there any point to really continuing like this? So it's nothing new, and like I said, I wish the man who originally came up with the idea had really followed through and written it himself. Well, of course, the man from Uncle was pretty off the wall, too. But
we're going to have to look him up on Wikipedia, because they've put a link. He's on Wikipedia.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we can look him up there.
Yeah.
You said something that I kind of sort of take offense to.
Oh, what is that?
Okay, you said that, yeah, anybody, if they were on the other side, would feel that way, and they don't even need to be on the other side. You're wrong, okay? You're a soldier. You're going through boot camp, okay? These people we're fighting are not people. They are not human. They are subhuman. They do not care about your life. They do not care about your children. They do not care about the United States of America.
You're just the enemy.
Okay, then why are we doing this story in the first place? What's the point?
No, I think what Rick Wall is saying, I assume, is that that's the mentality that a soldier has to keep in his head so that he's not thinking he's killing real people. He has to distance himself from them.
You're not involved, right.
All right, well, I have no argument with that. Well, I'm saying
I think it's a matter of you're not supposed to show any sentiment. I mean, you're a soldier. Your job is to kill the enemy. And if you show sentiment, I mean, you can't do that. You're a soldier. You've got to just defend your country, and you kill the enemy, and that's it.
So what is Sterling's point in sending him back there to be part
of
that?
So we can see from the other side.
So we're human beings, not just animals.
To walk in their footsteps, as it were.
All right, well, I don't have any real argument. I'm sorry you took offense, but I don't really have any argument with that. Let me just finish here. At the end of his review, this person says, I can appreciate Serling's sentiments, but not the pompous script or silly execution, including, despite its noble intentions, a Mickey Rooney turn from Stockwell, despite an affecting final few moments like Stockwell's Japanese accent, a quality of mercy is a bit too ridiculous, and he writes it deliberately that way, R-I-D-I-C-K-E-R-O-U-S. Yeah, I thought he looked ridiculous, and it kind of gave him a yellow complexion. And I think when you see that stuff, and I think that is racist. I think that's pretty bad. I didn't like that part of it at all. Talk about being offended. I was offended by that.
The way they made him look, I thought was terrible. And the accent was really bad.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, that's why this person writes this, that maybe Serling didn't mean to be racist in any way, but it almost comes across that way. When you see him, you know, it wasn't necessary, I think, to try to make him look Japanese. It just looks idiotic. And I just don't buy into it. Anyway, all I can say is that I agree, I can't say whether the Japanese or the Germans or anybody, you know, are subhuman. To me, the Germans were subhuman because I'm Jewish myself, and they put people in concentration camps and simply killed them for no reason. So I couldn't agree more that they are subhuman. Tell me about it. Yeah. But I'm only talking about this story, not about real life. I was comparing it to what could happen in real life, but this, in the story itself, there's really no point in doing this story. It's called A Quality of Mercy, meaning when I first watched the episode, they're trying to convince me that if only he could see it from the other side, he might change his mind. He might be different, but he wouldn't be any different because of what was just said here. So it's pointless. It's a pointless episode. There's nothing to be gained by, nothing to be learned by. It's not going to change anybody's mind. I gave it a 1.
You gave it a 1?
Yeah, I gave it a 1 because I gave it a 1 for the acting, not for anything else.
Oh, yeah.
It's got some very good actors in it. It's too bad they weren't given really anything to do. But it's boring. In my review, I said this is the first time war has ever been this boring. And, absolutely nothing happens to it, and it just doesn't come to any particular end. So it's not the worst thing I've ever seen in the series, but I can't go any deeper than 1. That's it for me. That's just a 1.
Well, I don't know if everybody realizes this, but the Twilight Zone movie, the very first episode, the one with
right, same thing, yeah.
That episode in the movie with Vic Morrow was taken from this episode.
Okay, I don't doubt that for a minute.
Loosely taken.
I thought that was the praise from of Pip episode.
Which one?
I thought that was supposed to be the praise
with
of
Jack Klugman. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because he was in Vietnam and his son was killed in Vietnam.
Right.
In both episodes. So, no, I don't think it is taken from here. It's taken from praise from Pitt.
No, really, because I just read somewhere in one of the reference books that they took it from that. But see, it's just these reference books aren't always right either. You know, so you can't always tell what's right and what's not. But, oh, and by the way, Ed wrote something here. He said that Bobby, you were asking about how he could just turn Japanese all of a sudden, and Ed said it's the Twilight Zone, the place where toys climb out of donation bins. Does he need a reason for turning Japanese?
Well, that's what I don't like about it, because I don't like the mixture of real-life war and science fiction. It's just too bizarre. It's a little too bizarre. Even in the Twilight Zone, it's a little too bizarre for me. Because I was caught up in the beginning of it when I thought to myself, these soldiers have had it. It's near the end of the war, and they're not going to simply go in and kill more people just to please him. And that's a more interesting story than getting off in this tangent about whether or not you could change somebody's mind if they only could see the other side. So that was my problem. All right, Lynn, that's it for me. Before I offend anybody else,
okay.
You better give it to somebody else.
Sure. I was offended by the fact that they made him use that lousy accent. I hated that.
Well, it looks absurd. It looks ridiculous.
Yeah, that offended me. But let's hear from Dave.
Okay, I hope we will actually hear from Robert. I hope he is editing in his own comments as well as doing the clips. Thank you, Robert. I think one of the reasons why the title of this, I haven't rewatched it recently, although I have watched it a few years ago since originally watching it, of course. And I agree with Bobby. I think Quality of Mercy, it's a bit of a stretch. It doesn't really seem to fit. But then I think I'm remembering correctly, isn't there a saying that mercy is the first casualty of war? So I wonder whether it was a play on that.
Sounds familiar to me. I've heard it somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's probably why he latched onto that. And, of course, in essence, the very fact of the fact that this the bomb has been dropped takes the decision out of this soldier's hands anyway. In one set, he almost doesn't really need to learn this lesson because events overtake his decision in a way. I can't remember just at the top of my head, perhaps somebody in the room can remind me, whether he changes his mind before he hears that the A-bomb has been dropped, or the word's gotten around about the A-bomb, and then he changes his mind. Because in effect, if the A-bomb news goes first, then that basically negates the whole storyline in a way, because there's no way the soldiers would have gone forward after that, because they've been ordered not to attack the cave. So perhaps, yeah. Okay. Of course. Again, trying to think back on it, to me, it's got a lot of importance, this episode, simply because of the cast in it. I'll mention first of all the Albert's Slamy one that Lynn mentioned. Of course, he was been in these three episodes, including the execution. And I agree with you, Lynn. He always seems to play. My description of his acting is bluster acting. He's always the big sort of bully blusterer that comes in, you know.
Yeah.
On a short fuse type of guy. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that in a way, because in the 60s, an awful lot of TV actors. I mean, you'll have to look at some of these people's resumes, and they go from, like, you know, one police story to a cowboy story to a detective story to a crime mystery to a, and they basically do the rounds of all the TV series that ran on TV.
Well, he was a regular actor. He was a regular on the Daniel. Remember Daniel Boone?
Yes.
With
Seth
Parker, Daniel Boone. He was a regular. Albert Salmi was a regular on there, and he played Daniel, kind of Daniel Boone's sidekick, and he was kind of a tough guy there too. A nice guy, but a tough guy.
Early TV was the same way as film. The what do you call it? Like the
jobbing,
studio
jobbing actors, were they? Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean the studio system is what I'm trying to say.
Ah,
you know?
Right. Don't contract.
You're signed for a cop show. That's what you're gonna do. If it's not Car 54, you're gonna do Dragnet or what else.
Streets of San Francisco, and then something else. Yeah. So that was that. Of course, as you mentioned, Dean Scott Stockwell, who I like, and I'm sure that one of the clips we will have heard by now is from for Dean Stockwell. Of course, is his work in Quantum Leap, particularly the season three. Two-part opener. The two-part opener, The Leap Home and The Leap Home Part 2, which take part in Vietnam. And his character in that, Dean Stockwell, plays a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. So that is, I mean, we say that these lessons are supposed to be learnt in war, but it seems every generation there needs to be another war, and people have to try and learn the lesson all over again. I don't know. and, of course, he's been in other science fiction still. I mean, he's 75, 76 now, Dean Stockwell, and only up to about two or three years ago, I think he was in the new Battlestar Galactica. So he's appeared in an awful lot of good television stuff.
I completely forgot about him in Quantum Leap. I'm glad you reminded me of that.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I can remember what he's been in, yeah.
And, of course, this is 30 years later he's in Quantum Leap. Well, season three was.
Yeah.
That was 90 to 91. And, and of course, you mentioned Leonard Nimoy playing Spock from the original Star Trek series, made appearances in some of the other, and, of course, in the movies. Yeah. And one of the other actors here, of course, Michael Patakak, is it? Pataki. He also was in Star Trek. He played one of the Klingons in the Trouble with Tribbles episode, Korax. So again, whether you know, Robert makes a reference to that, I don't know. But so it was quite a good cast, and I think I'm going to agree with Bobby. I've got a feeling that there was some interference with this script, and it was bent maybe into a shape it shouldn't have been in. And maybe if there's any chance of seeing what the original transcript of the story was by Sam Rolfe, then it might have been a better story. But all in all, we have revisited this story, the War Weary Soldiers. We've done it from the Civil War. We've done it from certainly the Second World War. Obviously, we haven't done it from Vietnam because Vietnam hadn't happened at this point in time.
Right.
But if it had, I'm sure it would have featured. So, all in all, I think, I don't know whether the previous people have gone and given a rating, I can't remember, but I would give this a solid 3 out of 5, simply because of the quality of the cast. And I suppose it is a gritty storyline. One of the things that a few of us have perhaps complained about recently is there's been a little bit too much humour injected into a spate of Quantum Leap episodes, perhaps a little bit too light-hearted. And maybe this was one of these episodes where they felt as though they had to show that they did have a range of stories and have a little bit more grit and a little bit more serious topic line in it. So
yeah.
I'm just looking. I don't think there's anything else I really need to add into that. But yeah, I think a solid 3 out of 5 from me on that.
Yeah, you gave it a 3, and I gave it a 2 for the acting mainly. And Bobby gave it a 1, but he mainly gave it a 1 for the acting. I feel bad that I didn't check to see what Robert gave it, but I'm sure he gave it a 2.
I think it was 2.5. It was 2.5 or 3. 2.5. I think it was 2.5.
All right, yeah. Yeah, he's usually a little bit more generous, sure. And Rick, how about you?
Rick, wait. Hello? Am I here?
Yep.
You're here.
Yeah, I self-muted myself because Daphne was making some noises. But anyway.
I heard her. She's a sweetheart. Leave her alone.
Well, you don't want to hear her barking over me now, do you?
All dogs are angels. Love them all.
Anywho, I disagree, like I do a lot. I like this episode.
Well, I said 3 out of 5.
Okay.
That's not a bad rating.
You know, again, like I said, you know, I personally think that if a soldier ever could or would look through the enemy's eyes and live their life and whatnot, there wouldn't be any war.
Well, that's why they send them through training, isn't it? They get them to stab first and not ask questions later. I mean, it's drilled into them and drilled into them and drilled into them.
Yep.
Become hard, you know, just have a hard shell and not, you can't let any compassion or any feelings come through. Yeah.
Yeah.
You are there to kill the enemy.
I'm not exactly sure if you guys have done it or if we're going to do it or whatnot. But there's another episode that's very similar, and that is Soldier.
That's not in this series.
Oh, right. That's Outer Limits. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that'll be Twilight. The next show we do. Maybe that'll be the next show that we do. Twilight Zone, we got to think of something else.
Anywho, but all right. The stories are very similar. Acting wise, I have no problem. And I don't know. You know, back then, they always had white people doing black parts, Japanese, Chinese, whatever. I mean, hell, Chris Lee played the part of Fu Manchu.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Especially they couldn't have done what they did with Quantum Leap later, and that is that when the camera looks at him, we see Dean Stockwell, but when the enemy look at him, they see a Japanese actor. You know, do you mean like, because like in Quantum Leap, people don't see Sam, they see whoever's body he's in, don't they? So yes. Because they couldn't have done it like that.
Technology wasn't there and nobody thought of it.
No, I mean just switch the person. I don't mean any clever, just I suppose they would have thought it would have confused the viewer at that time.
The first show I ever know of to do something like that is, again, a British show, and it's later in the 60s, and I believe it was called The Schizoid Man from The Prisoner.
That sounds correct.
When Patrick McGowan did the voice and another actor was playing him. He supposedly switched minds with another character.
Right. I think you're right on that one.
Yeah. And that's, as far as I know, I could be wrong. I'm not a TV historian by any count, but I believe that was the first time something like you just suggested has been done. I think I know because a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes, the budget was, I'd say, at least half of the Prisoner's budget. So it could be a matter of budget. Not that they cared about that too much back then.
That's true.
I don't know. I'll give it a 4.
Ooh.
A 4? Well, that's cool. All right. I like when it's a little bit all over the board. I like when we get, like, some that love it and some that hate it. I hate when it's all the same, you know?
Yeah.
But that's good. I'm glad.
Was it a classic episode? Not really, but I happen to like it.
No.
I've given excellent ratings to some episodes I didn't consider classic. I mean, you know, which one do I? Oh, the one that we're going to be doing next. The one we're doing next, Nothing in the Dark. I mean, I give that an excellent rating, but I do not consider it classic, but it is an excellent episode. So, you know, it doesn't mean it's classic. Just
it's because it's got Robert Redford in it, I know.
Yeah, there you go. Back when he still looked good. Back before his face looked like a catcher's mitt. But now, thank you, Rick. And now I'd like to turn this over to our good friend, Ed.
Hey, guys.
Hello, Ed.
Can you hear me okay?
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
Fine.
Hey, how's it going? All right.
All right.
Hey, I didn't hear the clips. Is Bobby not on tonight?
I'm here.
Bobby's here.
Oh, you missed what I had to say?
It's Robert that does the clip.
You actually missed what I had to say.
Oh, Robert's not here, unfortunately. Yeah, he's on vacation this weekend.
We'll hear the clips of the recording later.
All right.
He's going to ask for a couple of things later on.
Oh, okay. Well, now, after our last episode, you know, five characters in search of the Migdid, which I enjoyed a lot. Wow, this is kind of a come down. I'm gonna go along with what other people have said about different episodes. I was bored by this one, but I get the point. I mean, it was, you know, supposed to get you to give up putting yourself in the shoes of another person, which, you know, there's more than one way to look at a situation, and you know, I get the point, and it wasn't. I shouldn't call it terrible because there are worse episodes than this, but. And the acting wasn't bad, except for Dean Stockwell's accent, but I'm not going to harp on that anymore. It was bad, though. It was very bad.
He was still in his method acting stage, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He needed more methods.
Yeah, really. I don't think there were Chinese approaches around back then, you know? Who knows? Anyway, it's not more Chinese to me than Japanese. But, you know, honestly, I couldn't get past that. The whole episode... the part that he was in the character of the Japanese soldier. I could not get past the accent. And, you know, I think it would have been more effective if they had an actual Japanese person play Dean Stockwell's character instead. You know, just switch them out.
Yes, exactly. Exactly what I thought.
Thank you. He had all these other Japanese people. So why would you, I mean, I understand it needed an American person to turn. But why couldn't they have it the other way around? Well, no, you couldn't do that either. But I don't know. Well, they could have had Dean Stockwell play the American and then had a Japanese person. Is that what you're saying, Ed? A Japanese person who was supposed to be him?
Yeah.
All right. That makes more sense.
Why not have him change places and have him end up with the Japanese and the Japanese end up with the Americans?
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have worked.
That would have had to be an hour episode for that. But yeah, it would have been interesting.
No, we don't want that.
Yeah, it's called Face Off, that, I think. Face Off.
That's it. Face Off, exactly.
No. Well, anyway. But, you know, as I said in the past, I have a way of telling if I'm bored with an episode, and that's when I pay far too much attention to things that are happening around the storyline. And I got towards the end of this episode. Now, right near the end, where they all hear that the bomb's been dropped, the war's going to be over soon, and you hear all those cheering effects at the end. Did anybody else giggle at the cheering effect? That a couple of them didn't even sound like men. Like they had a couple of women standing out there in the field.
It
sounded like a 20-something-year-old woman cheering in the background. Yeah, or a man with testosterone shoes. I don't know. But
I have to listen to that again.
Yeah, listen, it's right around 23 minutes. You'll hear it. You hear all the cheering, and you hear two of them sound like, could it possibly be a man cheering? It doesn't sound like it, anyway.
It would be everyone in the studio, wouldn't it?
Well, it's not like they were added in later, you know, but actors probably didn't.
Maybe it was that, who was that woman that was the real popular on the radio back then, Saigon Sue or something, what was her name?
Oh, I don't
know. She was on the radio for a long time. She was the big radio announcer over there when the loud. No, actually, she was Korean. Never mind.
Tokyo Rose, you're talking. You talking about Tokyo Rose?
Yeah, it could have been. Damn, maybe that was Tokyo Rose. There you go. Oh my God!
Who
knows?
It was probably a canned applause effect.
Yeah, exactly.
The same one
that they had back then,
yeah.
All the time.
It's the same one they used on I Love Lucy.
Yep, probably.
The I Love Lucy people. Oh no! So what do you give this, Ed? What will you give it, a two or a three?
Well,
or what?
I'd give it, you know, like I said, it wasn't awful, wasn't fantastic. I think because the way it was handled, the story could have been good if it was, I think, directed differently. I'd give it a 2 out of 5.
Two? Okay. That's what I gave it. I'd give it a two.
By the way, as for what, you know, a few others have said for what we perceive as racism, which clearly, you know, we could interpret it that way now. I think mostly just appears to be racist to us now. You know, in this, you know, like seeing this episode where he pretends to be another race. Uses the accent of another race. He uses the term for Japanese that we don't really use anymore.
Yeah.
But that was common, you know, in decades past. I try to judge, you know, either historical TV shows or movies based on the norms of the time. And at the time, this wasn't a big deal. You know, nowadays we look at it through different eyes. So, yeah, it's offensive to us now, but, yeah, you know.
If I can say something about that a little
sure.
bit. My father, who just died a couple of years ago at 92, would always call black people the N-word.
Right.
Okay? Nobody cared because they looked at him and saw how old he was and said, oh, yeah, okay. Back then, they called us that all the time. It's okay.
Oh, they figure old people have a license to say whatever they want, yeah. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
92, he can say what he wants, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I guess it's, at the time, nobody knew any better. You know, hey, if we want to call it the J word, I don't want to offend anybody, but the J word was used on the headlines for the New York Times, you know, when the war ended.
Oh, yeah, it was on in the news.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a big deal. You know, it just seems to be to us now. But... anyway,
well,
so
now,
yeah, 2 out of 5.
Sorry, I was going to say, one of the things they do now is they don't say that in the Second World War we're at war with Germany. They always say we were at war with Nazi Germany. So it was the movement that we were at war against, not the German people.
Right, exactly.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert. I just wanted to come on and give my review of A Quality of Mercy. I do apologize. I wasn't able to make the show that you're listening to right now. I was on vacation with my wife. We were in Put-in Bay, Ohio. And for some people who may not know what Put-in Bay is a island off of the coast of the north of Ohio in Lake Erie. But what Put-in Bay is well known for is the War of 1812. It was the location of the squadron of U.S. Naval Commander Oliver Hazard Perry, who sailed from the port on September 10, 1813, to engage a British squadron just north of the island in the Battle of Lake Erie. Now, you can hunt all this up on the internet if you'd like to find out more information about Put-in Bay. The village is populated a lot during the summer. I mean, the normal population during the 2000 census was only 128 people. So, being 13 years later, it's probably just a little bit more, but not much. But it's a famous summer resort and recreational destination for people to go and just relax, You take the ferry from the mainland over to the island. Another popular island around there is called Kelly's Island. I just got back from that. It was very nice. It was very warm weather, 80 degrees, and all in all, fun for all, so to say. But let's get back to the review of A Quality of Mercy. We've heard the old saying, don't judge a man until you have walked a mile in his shoes, or judge another person's life till you've been forced to live it. They were the sayings that I was thinking of when I was watching this episode. You have two main characters in this story, which is set towards the end of World War II in the Pacific Theater of the War. Now, Albert Sly, we've seen him in Execution Season 1 and some other Twilight Zone episodes. He plays the sergeant, tired American soldier who is ordered to overrun a cave with his men where some Japanese are holed up by Lieutenant Cattell, played by Gene Stockwell, as you know, of Quantum Leap fame. As they get set to overrun the cave, the lieutenant is teleported, transported, however you want to say it, either by mind or body, to 3 years earlier, into the body of a Japanese soldier. Well, you already heard all this in the beginning, but it just basically turns out that he gets to see what it's like being a Japanese soldier. Here, it's another morality play. You can insert any war into this. Would have worked. You could have done this as a World War I story. You could have done it as a Civil War. I mean, you know, whatever you would like to call it. A Northern soldier switches over to the South and it gets to experience what the South was like. Or an American soldier switches over to a German soldier. So like I said, anything could play in this story. In this one, we get Leonard Nimoy. Now, as you know, Leonard Nimoy plays Spock in the Star Trek series, but he also had some guest appearance roles, like on The Outer Limits and other shows, as well as William Shatner did. He was in Outer Limits and Twilight Zone and other shows, but he wasn't in this one. This one basically was Leonard Nimoy. And I think Nimoy only had like maybe a line or two, and that was basically about it. But I felt he was wasted as a background character in this story. This was indeed a body-switching story. It would remind me of the Freaky Friday.
Anna, honey, wake up.
Oh.
I have had it.
Ah!
Hurry up.
What? I'm ready.
For the Coleman family.
Bye, honey. Make good choices.
Mondays are manic.
I can't believe it. It's Jake.
He's not looking. He's totally looking.
Wednesdays are wild.
Yeah, yeah! Get out of my room!
And for Anna and Tess, there's never enough time to really understand each other.
What? Time's up. It's after six.
Ugh.
You're ruining my life!
But on Friday...
You think my life is perfect?
You couldn't last one day in my high school.
Cookie.
That's all about to change. Because things are going to get a little freaky.
Why am I in Anna's room?
This isn't mine. Those aren't mine. That's definitely not mine. So, you're in my body and I'm in your body.
I'm old. I beg your pardon.
Oh, I'm like the Crypt Keeper!
Honey!
Could you, like, chill for a sec? I want my body back!
My wedding's tomorrow!
I can't marry Ryan! Ew!
Platinum, cool.
Don't even think about it.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
This thong is killing me.
Lindsay Lohan.
It's a great bike.
What?
Not like I've ever been on it. I'm not allowed.
Walt Disney Pictures presents... A movie about what it takes...
I can't do this.
What do you mean?
...to make someone else's dream...
Do something!
...come true.
When what you see is what you lack...
Then selfless love will change you back.
Why don't we like...
Yes, a jolt! Go!
Oh.
Okay, that was stupid.
stupid.
Freaky Friday.
Where is Harry's school?
I can walk from here.
It's 20 blocks.
Run fast.
Or 18 again type stories that came later on. Or it may have been just a mind switch situation more than anything. Years later, this episode idea was used, of course, in the first section of the 1983 Twilight Zone movie with Vic Morrow. Now, what's kind of interesting with this as well is Dean Stockwell appears in the Vic Morrow series Combat as a soldier in that one. So that's kind of a little coincidence. Also, being in various movies and TV roles, but also played the hologram Al in the Quantum Leap series. Kind of something similar with the Sam Beckett character, who was played by Scott Bakula in The Leap Home, Season 3, Episode 1 and 2, which was a two-parter where Sam leaps into his younger self as a high school teenager on the basketball team, and he tries to prevent things from happening in his family life. We see in that one he leaps into the second part where he's leaped into the body of a soldier in his brother's platoon to keep his brother from dying. We also get the episode Shock Treatment, episode 22, where we get the start of the story where Sam is getting, at the end of season 3, shock treatment, and the lightning strikes him and Al the hologram, to where in the next episode, the leap back, we have the body switch where this time Sam is the hologram and Al is the leaper, and he leaps into a World War II soldier, and that was the first episode of season 4. So very familiar themes with this story. I only gave this a 2.5 out of 5, but it was a very average story. And also something to focus on was the racism in this episode. When he switches back, Keitel switches back to being the American soldier, he learns a lesson of humanity and racism as well in this story. They had a thing back then called Yellowface, and what it was they would get white actors to portray Asians. A good example for Doctor Who fans out there is The Talons of Wang Chang, where one of the main characters was a white person, but he was in yellowface for the role in that story. Same thing with Dean Stockwell character Keitel, where when he switches over to the Japanese, he's painted in yellowface as well. That upset a lot of Asian Americans during that time that was looking for work as actors, and where their role, where normally an Asian person would fit into that role, they felt that somebody else who was better, and even if that person was white, they would do that kind of format. But that's pretty much died out pretty much. And I think they're giving Asians and Spanish and other international people, including Asian Americans and others, the chance to act in films and TV shows. Not like it was back in the 50s and 40s. Even with the Charlie Chan movies, I think that was the same situation with that as well. Again, 2.5 out of 5, I rated this. Everybody take care, and I'll talk to you then. Now back to the Talking Twilight Zone.
Well, it looks like this one, yeah, is kind of all over the board. We've got a 1, we've got a couple of 2s, we've got a 3, and we got a 4, which is great. I love that we have it all over the place. And as I said, I didn't think it was a horrible episode. I wasn't one of the best, but nothing that I wouldn't watch when it comes on a marathon. Of course, I would watch it again. I just hated the accent. I hated the way they made them look. But other than that, you know, they could have used a better makeup artist. You know, it wasn't the worst thing I've seen. You know, exactly. But I'm looking more forward to the next one we're going to be doing, and that'll be in 2 weeks. And that'll be on Saturday, July 7th, right after the 4th of July. So I know some people will be going away for 4th of July weekend, but I hope most of you will be here. And that is going to be Nothing in the Dark, which, of course, stars Robert Redford, which is, you know, we all know what a wonderful actor he is. And, of course, the wonderfully amazing Gladys Cooper, who was phenomenal in that episode. And I'm very much looking forward because it is a favorite episode of mine. It's not, to me, a classic, but it's damn close. You know, it's like, I'll tell you right now, I give it an excellent. But we're going to be seeing that. I'm not going to be seeing it. We're going to be talking about it in a couple of weeks. So I hope everyone is going to be here so we can have some
fun
with
that
one.
We'll try.
Oh, Rick, just be here, all right?
I'll be here.
You've had your orders.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Listen, what?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. All right, so I will see you guys in a couple of weeks, and I hope everyone has a wonderful rest of the weekend, and thanks for being here today, and I'll see you all in 2 weeks. Bye, guys.
So long.
Bye. Bye.
Allowed to talk about the incident with the movie?
Well, sure, it's free country.
Okay, now, this is going to get into something that has haunted you for a long time. It was the Twilight Zone movie. It was up at Indian Dunes, and you were flying a helicopter, and it was on the Twilight Zone. Take us back to that moment.
Well, we have to go back to 1982, and it was July. It was a very hot evening, and we had planned to get the filming done the night before. It just didn't work out. There were too many complications, and as it turned out, we finished the filming the next morning. And during the final take, a series of poorly timed pyrotechnician explosions took out the tail rotor and spun and crashed. And the results of that were Vic Morrow and two children were killed.
Now, after that, that wasn't where it ended, though. After that, it became something where they tried to actually say that you were at fault on that, right?
Well, they came down...
Everybody was at fault.
Sure, they came down to five defendants with the film, the producers of the movie, and the pyrotechnics chief and myself were named as the five defendants, right?
So did that, I mean, that had to be a horrifying part of your life, for sure.
How long did the court thing go on?
It went on 6 years, Bruce.
Oof.
Oh.
There was a pretrial, and then that took forever, and then after the pretrial got going, of course, there were the NTSB hearings before that, and so, you know, they put us through the grill.
And ultimately, you know that the pyrotechnics actually blew up the tail roller and crashed the helicopter in your heart, and you knew what happened, but you don't know what they're going to come up with in a court case either, though, do you?
No, and we actually weren't sure exactly what had happened to the tail rotor. As it turned out, it was baked off in the heat of the fireball, which wasn't supposed to be there at the time, but, you know, it was thought by many, including the prosecution, the NTSB fellow on suggested at one time that a paint can lid had flown up in the explosion and taken out the tail rotor. But that was disproved, and finally the defense came up with a very credible, detailed analysis of how the heat from the fireball unbaked the tail rotor. Because the tail rotor, when it was produced, was baked into position.
Carbon fiber type of thing.
Well, no, it wasn't carbon fiber. This is aluminum over a honeycomb structure, and it's baked in an oven. It cures, cools down, and it never comes apart unless you heat it back up again. And that's what happened. This fireball wasn't supposed to be there. Tail rotor came apart, and that was the end of it.
Wow. So, man, that had to be, I mean, 6 years of your life that you have no idea that it's not going to, the whole thing's not going to be pinned on you.
Well, it sure looked like they were going after Landis. I mean, everybody kind of agrees with that. There were two books written about the trial and everything that came out of it. And everyone seemed to focus on John Landis, and rightfully so. It was his movie, called all the shots, and the analysis After it was all over, the jury decided that we were not at fault.